Why are we being denied the truth? The moderator in yesterday's debate was not interested in the truth. She was interested in controlling the kids in the class to make sure they didn't throw spitballs at each other and they didn't scream at each other. But we didn't get to the bottom of any issues. We didn't get to know whether the laptop really belongs to Hunter Biden. We didn't get to know what the president would do if he lost the election and believed that it was rigged. We didn't get to know about Joe Biden's plans for court packing. We, the public, the viewers, were denied the right to get to the bottom of these issues by moderators and media that don't ask hard questions. I'm a dissenter about yesterday's debate. Kristen Welker is getting praised from all quarters for what a wonderful job she did in controlling the debaters and in moderating the debate. I think that shows us the low expectations we have of moderators and of debates. She reminded me of a school teacher in an elementary school with lots of disciplinary problems who thinks that she had a successful teaching day when she controlled the students without teaching them anything or asking them any hard questions. You know, where I grew up, we were always asked by our parents in school, did you ask a good question today? Well, by that standard, I think that Welker failed miserably. She did not ask good questions. She threw softballs at both debaters, and there were no follow-ups. Who can imagine a debate on the eve of the election without President Trump being asked the obvious question, will you today make a commitment that if you lose this election, you will accept a peaceful transition? And a follow-up. If he says yes, if he says no, that's what debates are supposed to be about. Or when she asked President Trump the question, what would you tell black parents about how to speak to their children to make sure that they're not killed when they're stopped in a traffic stop? He didn't answer that question. Instead, he went on and talked, understandably, about things he believes he's done for the black community, African-American colleges, investment zones, etc. Perfectly reasonable statements, but not an answer to the question. So the follow-up should be, all right, we've heard that, but now tell us, what would you say to black parents? What would you tell them about why they have to give this talk to students? And she failed even worse when it came to former Vice President Biden. Not a single question, court packing? We want to know. He has told us he's going to tell us about court packing. So you don't ask him about court packing when that's something that's clearly on the mind of lots and lots of people? You don't ask him the simple question. All right, you say that it's all Russian disinformation through Rudy Giuliani. I want to ask you a direct question. That laptop, was it Hunter Biden's? Do you know? Are the emails on the laptop Hunter Biden's emails? No questions about that. He was able to get away with simply saying it's Russian disinformation and there's no proof that I took any money. The issue is not whether he took any money. The issue is whether there was any discussion about the big man and about 10% and about how the son would be compensated for making introductions. Total failure when it came to that important issue. And for me, the most important failure is here you have the Vice President of the United States, former Vice President, saying that President Trump abandoned his allies and helped his enemies. The obvious follow-up is abandoned his allies? Did he abandon Israel when he moved the embassy and recognized the Golan Heights? Did he abandon the Gulf states when he created normal relations between Israel and the Gulf states? Did Barack Obama and you, Vice President Biden, abandon your friends in the Middle East when you made a deal with Iran, giving them billions of dollars in cash to use for terrorism against American allies? There may be answers to those questions, but where were the questions? You know, we expect so little from debates these days. We expect so little from moderators that, as somebody said today, the winner last night was the mute button. Okay, the mute button, but we expect more. We did not get substantive answers to hard questions. This morning I was listening to some of the commentators, even some of the media critics. She asked hard questions. Yeah, name a single hard question she asked. There wasn't a single hard question. There wasn't a single question that really didn't give the debaters an opportunity just to use their talking points. There wasn't a single follow-up question. Yeah, we had no shouting and talking over each other. Yeah, that's the school marm. That's the school teacher. I wouldn't send my kids to a school where the teacher at the end of the day said, "Whoa, that was a great class. Nobody talked over anybody else. Nobody screamed at each other. I didn't teach them anything. I didn't ask them any hard questions. I didn't make them use their brains, but that's not my job. My job is as a disciplinarian." As a disciplinarian, she gets an A+. As a moderator of a real debate, D- with grade inflation. We expect more. Debates have become absolutely useless. We're going into this election. Many people have already voted, many people have not, without knowing the answers to critical questions. We still don't know whether Vice President Biden's going to support court packing. I think he won't, but who knows? We still don't know what attitude President Trump is going to take if he loses the election and loses in a court. Those were areas that should have been probed, should have been inquired. There was almost nothing yesterday about foreign policy. There was very little about tax policy. One brief reference about tax policy. It was a debate about issues that we're never going to resolve. Who's to blame for the virus? You know, did President Obama and Vice President Biden do enough during their 8 years? You know, a lot of talking points. I'll tell you again, the winners were those who prepped the two candidates for the debate because they prepped them well. They prepped them for softball questions, standard answers written out in advance. And I don't know whether they prepped them for follow-ups because we never got an opportunity. Look, maybe I'm spoiled. I'm a lawyer. I cross-examine. I never accept the first answer that a person gives on the witness stand. I don't ask questions in order to make the witness look good. I ask questions in order to elicit from them information they don't want to give me. I challenge anybody to find one question yesterday which was designed to get an answer that the person did not want to give. And if there was such a question and the person, the debater, didn't give the answer, no follow-up. So I'm very disappointed in the debate. I don't think it changed very many minds. If the polls are accurate, we never know about polls being accurate, particularly with President Donald Trump, who defies polls in many respects. If the polls are accurate, and if in fact Biden is ahead in the contested states, then this was probably a win for Biden because Trump didn't gain many, many major points. He made some good points, but I can't imagine that he switched very many independents or Democrats or undecideds to his side. He did show himself as restrained, as capable of having a serious conversation. It was a very different Donald Trump, not because of the moderator necessarily, not even because of the rules about muting. I think he made a decision to be a very different Donald Trump. By the way, he was a very different Donald Trump in the 60-minute interview. Interesting tactic that Donald Trump used. You know, he was interviewed by 60 Minutes. He didn't like the interview. And so he put the interview on his website. So now you don't have to watch 60 Minutes. You can watch the outtakes, which are much more interesting than watching the edited version of 60 Minutes. Obviously, by doing so, he violated understandings that you often have. I've been interviewed by 60 Minutes on two or three occasions, and the understanding is, even though you can tape record for your own purposes, you don't reveal the content of the interview until it's showed on the air. He decided to violate that rule, and he has put the entire interview from beginning to end. He comes off very well in that interview, and the interviewer comes off quite poorly. Is it too late at this point for him to catch up? I don't know. I'm not a pollster. I'm not a politician. And I'm not going to tell you again my personal feelings on the election. I do think from an analytical point of view, though, we are the losers. We, the voters, are the losers. We don't have enough information. We should have President Trump's tax returns. We should have the laptop material. We should be able to read critically. We should not have Twitter and Facebook censoring for us, telling us what we should read and what we shouldn't read. The answer to bad speech is more speech. And we didn't get that. We haven't gotten that. So I think a lot of voters will cast their ballots without having the information that would make them better voters. This is it. No more debates. I suspect there'll be no more October surprises. It's now just a few days, a week and a few days before the election. My prediction, we'll know the winner on election night. I know a lot of people are saying no. Will we know the winner in a way that is acceptable to everybody on election night? I don't know about that. But I think we will see CNN and Fox and the networks predict a winner, and it will be the same winner predicted by all the networks. I can't be sure of that. That didn't happen in 2000, and it may not happen again in 2020, but I think that's what's going to be the result of this election. While we're talking about objectivity and subjectivity, I want to spend just a minute on one of the big disappointments in my own life as a reader of the media. I used to love the New York Times. I used to count on the New York Times. I used to write for the New York Times regularly. I was the most frequent lawyer op-ed writer for the New York Times going back to the late 1960s. It's no longer my New York Times. It's become the captive of its young staff members who are graduates of intersectionalist colleges and who see the world through the aura of race, of gender, of identity politics. You cannot get a fair assessment of the news on the front page of the New York Times. They have what's called news analysis, which is really putting editorials on the front page of the paper. The editorials, of course, are completely one-sided. Even the conservatives, who occasionally get to write for them, write anti-Trump editorials. So you can't get a balanced view of this election from the New York Times. But this weekend's New York Times goes even further than it has in the past, when it had Peter Beinart writing an op-ed calling for the end of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. That was bad enough. This weekend, there's an article entitled Great, Great People. A laudatory article about one of the great people of American history. No, it's not Elie Wiesel. No, it's not any of the people you might think it is. No, it's not John Lewis. No, it's not Martin Luther King. It's Angela Davis. Angela Davis. Angela Davis, who ran for president as a member of the Communist Party. Angela Davis, whose guns were used, guns registered to her, used to kill police officers and prison guards. She was indicted, acquitted. I actually played a very small role in her case back in California, back in the late 60s, early 70s. I did some work on jury selection, not major at all. But then when she won the case, she was acquitted, and she went off to Moscow to receive the Lenin Peace Prize from the Soviet Union and the Communist Party. All right, that's her philosophy. I called her and I spoke to her assistants and I followed it up with a letter. And I said, look, I am defending some dissidents, some refuseniks in the Soviet Union, people like you, dissidents, human rights activists, Anatoly Sharansky, Sakharov, you name it. I was defending these dissidents. It would be great if you, when receiving the Peace Prize for your dissents in the United States, could say a positive word about these people, two of whom were facing the death penalty. Others were facing life imprisonment, death on the installment plan. And you know what she said in response? This is Angela Davis, who's being praised by the New York Times. She said, these are not human rights activists you're defending. These are Zionist fascist attackers on communism. They deserve to be in prison. Yes, I will speak up. I will speak up against them, not in their favor. This is a human rights activist speaking up against Sharansky, against Sakharov, in favor of communist totalitarianism. Why is the Times not telling that story? Why are they praising her? Because the young staff members of the New York Times and some of the young subscribers to the New York Times who dominate their policies these days see her as an icon. The fact that she is an anti-civil libertarian, that she's against free speech, that she favors and has always favored the Communist Party, that has been anti-American for generations, that doesn't become part of the story. That doesn't become part of the critique. You don't get a balanced assessment. No, you get praising of Angela Davis, praising of the Black Panther Party, which was a violent, murderous party. Yeah, sure, it had breakfasts for kids. So did the Ku Klux Klan have breakfasts for kids. You don't praise racist organizations like the Klan or the Panthers just because they do some good. And if you're going to praise Angela Davis in the New York Times and list her among the great people, the greats, at least tell the whole story so that people can judge. So the theme of today's Der Show is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We're not getting it. We're not getting it from debate moderators. We're not getting it from the candidates. We're not getting it from the New York Times. We're not getting it from many in the media, which is why you have to keep watching the Der Show, because you're going to get all sides of every story here. There's no censorship here. You're not going to get Facebook and Twitter telling me what to say. And you're not going to get a moderator not asking hard questions. I'm going to ask hard questions of both sides, of all sides, and of the media, and of everybody else. That's my job, to cross-examine people who don't want to give information and make them give information. You'll hear it from the guests I have on the show, and you'll hear it from my monologues. So that's today's Der Show, a critique of moderators, media, and the lack of interest in getting to the bottom and getting to the truth. Somebody once called cross-examination the greatest engine ever devised by human beings to achieve the truth. That may be an overstatement, but it's a heck of a lot better than softball questions being asked by a moderator in a presidential debate and softball profiles being done of people who have done very evil things in their lives while hiding the evil things that they've done. You want the truth? You're going to get it on the Der Show. Now we come to my favorite part of the show, calls and comments from my listeners and viewers, Craig in Florida.
Hi, Mr. Dershowitz. I really enjoy your podcast. It's very informative. My name's Craig. I am from Tampa Bay area in Florida. And my question is, I'd like to know if the impeachment of a president can be overturned if it's found out that what he was impeached for is not true. And thank you, and I look forward to your answer.
Great question. Good luck to Tampa Bay in the World Series. I'm rooting for the L.A. Dodgers because, you know, I come from Brooklyn, and the Dodgers used to be in Brooklyn. I'm furious at them for moving to L.A., but, you know, old allegiances die hard. But so far, it's been a really great World Series. I don't think you can undo an impeachment. The House could probably vote. They have their own rules. They could probably vote to rescind the impeachment. You know, one might argue the Senate undid the impeachment. Impeachment is, after all, only an indictment, not a charge. It's one-sided. It's just based on an assessment of the evidence against the president. The president doesn't get a chance to appear or testify or put on his own case or put on his own evidence, at least that he didn't in this case. He did in the Clinton impeachment to at least some degree. History is going to have to overrule this impeachment, as they have every other impeachment. So far, we've had three impeached presidents, and historians have concluded that all of them were impeached in error and unconstitutionally. Our next caller is from Mississippi. Eric.
Alan, I disagree with Megyn Kelly. I think you should continue with the suit. A lot of people think they can get away with this, such as the Antifa in Portland and the riots in these different locations. There was no retribution. There was no penalties for their actions. So they felt they could just continue to do it. And other people saw that and said, well, if they can get away with it, I can get away with it. A punishment is a deterrent to commit a crime. What this lady has done in these false accusations is a crime. Shouldn't be allowed to do it. I disagree with Megyn Kelly. I think you should continue on. Love your show. Thank you.
Thanks for your sage and wise advice. I agree with you that unless we deter people from bringing false charges, it's very profitable to do it. You know, people ask all the time, why would a woman subject herself to the criticism by bringing a false charge? Very simple. They can make millions of dollars. This woman has already made over $1 million, and she's going to continue to try to make money off false charges. Her whole life has been based on false charges and false accusations. And unless she's held accountable and others are held accountable, there won't be a deterrence against false charges. Instead, the law today deters the victims of false charges from bringing lawsuits, because if they lose the lawsuit, they may have to pay legal fees, etc. And so it's a very bad situation. And as you probably know, today anybody can accuse anybody of anything as long as they do it in court papers, and they're immune. And the newspapers pick it up, and they're immune. And then if you simply deny the accusation, you can be sued for defamation. Something very wrong with that system. Thanks for your advice. Our next call is from Texas. Michael.
Hey, Professor. This is Michael from Texas. During the ACB hearings, Judge Barrett was asked about Griswold. Can you please explain the decision?
Sure. The Griswold decision occurred while I was actually a student in New Haven, Connecticut. I was at Yale Law School. And in New Haven, they opened up a birth control clinic. It wasn't even an abortion clinic, just a birth control clinic where married women could go and seek advice to how to prevent pregnancies or how to control pregnancies. And a group of birth control people brought a lawsuit or closed the clinic down. I'm sorry, closed the clinic down, saying we're offended, even though we don't have to go into the clinic, we're offended by the fact that there exists in New Haven a clinic that allows people to use birth control. And the Supreme Court reversed that and said that people have the right to use birth control. It's part of the privacy inherent in the Constitution. And Griswold became the foundational case, ultimately, for a broader application in cases like Roe versus Wade. By the way, I think it's a big leap between Griswold and Roe. Griswold doesn't involve the rights of any other people. Nobody has the right to be offended by the fact that behind closed doors, birth control information is given out. But if a fetus is a human life at a certain point in time, at least there you have conflicting rights. You have the right of the fetus to be born. Courts have not recognized that right, and the right of the woman. So I, on the one hand, I put issues like gay rights. Nobody has the right to care whether or not gay people get married or gay people have romantic relationships. It's nobody's business. Nobody's hurt by that. Birth control, nobody's hurt by that. Roe versus Wade, abortion, it's a different issue. I support, ultimately, a woman's right to choose, but I do it conflicted. I do it knowing that there are other interests that could conceivably be involved. So it's a harder case, but Griswold is the beginning of the trend of cases that ultimately led to Roe versus Wade. Our next call comes from Los Angeles. Mark?
Regarding the false sex allegations against you, I think that for well-known people like yourself, remaining silent is just too passive of a response, especially when the media acts like bullies towards you. When you fight back, I see it as a kudos to you for standing up for yourself type of behavior. Maybe there is something elegant or spiritual about being quiet, turning the other cheek, but sometimes it's just necessary to be loud and make your feelings known, especially when you're being falsely accused. I don't have a question, but I just want to say thank you for sharing who you are and what you think. You are a blessing.
Oh, thank you so much for your kind words. Look, I agree with you about when you're a prominent person. All the newspapers lump me together with other people. Yesterday's New York Times, in talking about the Ghislaine Maxwell disclosures, say that Dershowitz and Prince Andrew were both accused and they both vehemently denied it. Well, there's a big difference. Prince Andrew denied it. I disproved it. I wrote a book about it. I put it all out there. I produced emails. I produced the manuscript. I produced the tape recording by her lawyer. I produced the tape recording by her best friend. To lump me together with Prince Andrew is wrong. Or another newspaper yesterday said, look what's happening to legal commentators. Judge Napolitano was accused of this, and Jeffrey Toobin was accused of this, and Dershowitz was accused as well. Well, there's, again, a big difference. I did not do what I was accused of. I did nothing wrong. So I have to fight back, and I can't be lumped together with other people who may have done things that aren't so bad, but they did them. Jeffrey Toobin did what he is accused of doing. I did not. And that's a big, big difference. And I don't deserve kudos or praise. I have nothing to hide, so I have nothing to lose by speaking out. I'm not Gary Hart, who foolishly said, you know, I challenge you to follow me around and you'll see I've done nothing wrong. Well, it turned out he didn't do nothing wrong. He did some things that were wrong. Not in my case. And so I understand your view, but I'm still taking Megan's point of view seriously. I haven't made a decision yet. Look, on this show, I'm going to talk about it, particularly if you ask me questions about it. From the day I was accused, I've never refused to answer a single question asked by any media about this, again, because I have nothing to hide. Yesterday, my lawyers made a motion in court, filed a letter in court, saying we wanted my names unredacted. My name is redacted in the Maxwell deposition. You read, oh, she said she had sex with blank, blank, crossed out. No. I want it to be in there. I want her perjury to be well known. So I'm not looking to redact my name. I want my name unredacted. I want every name unredacted. I want every document, every piece of paper made public. Our next call is from Indiana.
Thank you, Mr. Dershowitz. Tom Wilson here from Indiana. Do you actually believe, after watching Biden confess on TV that he'd never had anything to do with Tara Reid, unequivocally, I think it was the word, I'm not buying it. If you watched his eyes when he said those words and repeated them, his eyes jumped around and his head movement looked awful odd too, which tells me, and anyone probably can read it, would say he's probably lying and he is guilty, period. Would you come to that conclusion yourself, or you think it's would have to go to court first? Thank you very much.
I believe in the presumption of innocence for everybody, and I don't believe you can determine guilt by looking at people's eyes or movements. You have to look at hard evidence. I don't believe Joe Biden did what he was accused of doing. I've known Joe Biden for a long time. He doesn't strike me at all as that kind of a person. And again, there are no other accusations comparable to that over his 47 years of public life. So I have my serious doubts about it, but more importantly, presumption of innocence. I conclude a person is guilty only after seeing hard evidence of guilt and concluding that the evidence is overwhelmingly against the person. I think everybody in life is entitled to a presumption of innocence. I don't need a presumption of innocence in my case because there's no evidence at all, period. All I need is a fair opportunity to present the evidence, and so does Joe Biden. So I'm not going to conclude based on eye movements or other things that he may be guilty. It should turn on the evidence. Okay, this is our final caller for today.
Hi, Professor Dershowitz. Thank you for taking my comment. In terms of your guest, Megyn Kelly, I actually do agree with her in terms of her perspective on how you should deal and handle with the egregious and false charges being leveled against you. I think it's important to take a look at her example. I mean, she was let go from NBC. People called her a racist because she made a comment that was not, quote-unquote, politically correct. Everyone who knows Ms. Kelly professionally or personally knows that she is definitely not a racist, but you don't see her going around constantly defending herself. Same with you. You have a stellar character. Your record speaks for itself. Everybody who knows you personally and professionally knows that you are not guilty of sexual abuse, that these charges are patently false. I don't think you should constantly have to defend yourself. I also want to thank you for having Ms. Kelly on your program. She courageously did fight very powerful and influential men at Fox News when she was a victim of sexual abuse. And in doing so, she fought for all women who've been sexually abused or harassed at the workplace. And I'd also like to take this time to suggest another guest, another woman who's spent close to 60 years fighting for the rights of women and protecting women against sexual abuse and fighting for equality, has been one of the leaders of the second wave feminist movement, Dr. Phyllis Chesler. I think she would be a very interesting guest on your program, and I believe she does have a new book that's coming out very soon that I think your viewers might be very interested in. Thank you and have a very nice day. My name is Fern and I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for identifying yourself from Brooklyn. You want to really hear something funny? What a small world. You talked about Dr. Phyllis Chesler, one of my heroes. She has written great books. I actually assigned her book, Women in Madness, which was a path-breaking book in the second wave of feminism. Phyllis and I went to the movies together once when I was like 15 and she was 13. We literally had a date. I paid for the tickets. I was a gentleman. I bought a candy bar, like a Mounds bar, and we watched a movie together. We didn't date after that, but Phyllis and I have remained friends over many years. She is a great potential guest, and I will take you up on your recommendation. I think Phyllis is one of the smartest women and people in America today. But I want to comment about your point regarding Megyn Kelly. You say that you praise her because she was a victim and she stood up and stood up on behalf of all victims. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm a victim. I don't look like a victim. I don't sound like a victim. I don't behave like a victim. But I'm a victim of a crime. I'm a victim of perjury, of false accusations. I'm a victim of a violation of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not bear false witness. I am a victim, and I'm trying to speak up on behalf of all victims of false accusations of sexual abuse. Now, maybe I can do it without focusing so much on my own innocence, but it's a hard question. And so I very much appreciate your advice. And please, others of you who want to recommend guests, please do. I'm going to make a phone call as soon as I finish here today to Dr. Phyllis Chesler and ask her if she will be a guest on my show. She does have a new book about a serial killer in Florida, a woman, and I actually wrote a blurb for the book. It's a superb, superb book. And so I'd love to talk to her about that and about a range of other issues. Phyllis Chesler is a feminist and a civil libertarian and someone who believes in equality, and she's one of my heroes, and so I hope she will accept my invitation to be on the show. All right, you've heard The Dersh Show for today, critique of the media, great calls from callers. Please come back and listen next week to more of The Dersh Show.